Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. In today's program, Joan Lewis and I take a look at the varied events of the past few days in the Vatican, a week that has celebrated the life of the Church in its living and dead through the feasts of All Saints and All Souls. We will finish the program with a prayer from a saint. But first, loving God with every bit of one's mind, heart, body and soul is the most important thing in life. But it's impossible unless we also show love to the people around us. Jill Bevilacqua and Sean Patrick Lovett now reflect on the words of Jesus in the Gospel for this Sunday.
One of the scribes came up to Jesus and asked him, "Which is the first of all the commandments?" Jesus replied, "This is the first. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is Lord alone. Therefore you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. This is the second. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. There is no other commandment greater than these." The scribe said to him, "Excellent teacher, you are right in saying, 'He is the one, there is no other than He.' Yes, to love Him with all our heart, with all our thoughts, and with all our strength, and to love our neighbor as ourselves, is worth more than any burnt offering or sacrifice." Jesus approved the insight of this answer and told him, "You are not far from the reign of God." And no one had the courage to ask him any more questions.
From the account in last week's Gospel of the healing of the blind beggar, Bartimaeus, in Jericho, we've made a great leap. Jesus is now in Jerusalem and has been for the last few days. Indeed, these are his last days, for it is the Tuesday of what we know as Holy Week, and for the Jews these were the days leading up to the Passover. The Pharisees have done their best to entangle Jesus in his talk with the question of whether it was lawful to pay tribute to Caesar. Then the Sadducees, who didn't believe in the resurrection of the body, posed him the question of the woman who had married seven brothers. Jesus demolishes each group in turn. Told to render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's, the Pharisees marvelled, we read, and they left him and went away. But they can't have gone far, for this is what we hear next.
When the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they came together, and one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question to test him.
That's the Revised Standard Version of Matthew's account. The Jerusalem Bible is similar.
The Pharisees got together, and to disconcert him, one of them put a question.
In the Jerusalem Bible version of Mark's account, we read,
"One of the scribes who had listened to them debating and had observed how well Jesus had answered them now came up and put a question to him."
Similarly, the Revised Standard Version has this.
"One of the scribes came up and heard them disputing with one another, and seeing that he was answering them well, asked him."
What is interesting is the difference of emphasis between Matthew's and Mark's accounts. Mark tells us that the scribe was impressed by the way Jesus had answered the Sadducees. Matthew gives us a different reason for the scribe's query: to test him, to disconcert him, and in the Vulgate version, tempting him. What was the scribe's real attitude? Perhaps somewhat ambivalent. But after hearing our Lord's words, he comes down totally on the side of Jesus with an exclamation of approval, and then launches into his newly discovered understanding. But what prompted the particular question he asked? Didn't he know the order of the Ten Commandments? As children, we recited them in the order they were given to Moses on Mount Sinai, and the first was the longest of all, and very impressive it was.
"I am the Lord thy God, who brought thee out of the land of Egypt and out of the house of bondage. Thou shalt not have strange gods before me. Thou shalt not make to thyself any graven thing, or the likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or in the earth beneath, nor of those things that are in the waters under the earth. Thou shalt not adore them, nor serve them.
Probably children today learn a simplified version of the commandments, but I wonder, do they have the same effect of instilling awe? Was it only the preponderance of these and thous, or the majesty of the language then used that impressed us so much? None of us, of course, have had the accompaniment of what we might call the sound effects provided by God for the Israelites gathered that day on the great plain at the foot of Mount Sinai. Not even Hollywood has been able to reproduce them satisfactorily.
There were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud upon the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. Then Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they took their stand at the foot of the mountain, and Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in fire, and the smoke of it went up like the smoke of a kiln, and the whole mountain quaked greatly. And as the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him in thunder.
God was not playing games, as a scholar reminds us.
The manifestation on Mount Sinai, chosen by God as the focal point of his presence, has the purpose of inspiring a proper sense of respect for the majesty of God, who has allowed his people to meet him here and is about to proclaim his will to them.
The effects had their effect. The people, we read, shook with fear and kept their distance, asking Moses to act as interpreter, or middleman, if you like, between them and God. And Moses spoke words of comfort and explained what it meant to have what we know as fear of the Lord.
Do not be afraid. God has come to test you, so that your fear of him being always in your mind may keep you from sinning.
Later, as we know, Moses was called again by God to the top of Sinai, where he gave him the stone tablets with the law inscribed on them. But Moses stayed up there 40 days, and when he came down, he saw the people dancing round in adoration of the golden calf, and he hurled the tablets of stone down in fury. But to return to our scribe and his question, which is the first of all the commandments, it might seem a foolish query, except for one thing. The question the scribe poses refers not to 10 commandments, but to 613, 365 of which were negative, and 248 positive. A scholar explains.
These were various religious precepts which Jewish theology had catalogued according to symbolic calculations carried out on the basis of legislative texts of the Old Testament.
And another note goes into more detail.
The question of a distinction of importance among the commandments of the law was much discussed among the rabbis in the time of Jesus. One rabbinical text states precisely, "If the precepts are distinguished for greatness and importance, it is for practical and pastoral reasons. In the sense, there may be a greater and more important commandment. Which is the commandment that brings together all the others?" You answer, "The prohibition of the worship of idols." Famous is the answer of the great teacher Hillel to the pagan who asked him to teach the whole law standing on one leg. He said, "Do not do to your neighbour what is hateful to yourself. This is the whole of the law. The rest is its interpretation. Go and learn."
Hillel was a first century Jewish teacher, one of the most respected of his time, and, we're told, influential on later rabbinic Judaism. In answering the scribe's question, our Lord makes no reference to all the hundreds of precepts Jewish theology had developed, but he quotes the words of Moses to the people, and then of God to Moses. And the scholars again explain.
Jesus refers to two biblical passages from Deuteronomy, love for God with one's whole being, and from Leviticus, love for one's neighbour as for oneself. not so much to list two important commandments, but rather suggesting an interior attitude, constant and radical, the attitude of that love which pervades and transforms everything, giving life to morals and to worship itself. The whole of biblical law is summed up in this commitment to the way of total love for God and for our brothers. It is what the doctor scribe understands, receiving explicit praise from Jesus. It's the only time in the Gospels that the students of the biblical law, the scribes, that is, are commended.
And one thing the man says stands out, the comparison he makes with sacrifices and burnt offerings. Maybe he was thinking of those lines from Ecclesiasticus.
A man multiplies offerings by keeping the law. He offers communion sacrifices by following the commandments. By showing gratitude, he makes an offering of fine flour. By giving alms, he offers a sacrifice of praise.
The last part of our gospel suggests a kind of peace, as if there was at last some real possibility of understanding between Jesus and those who have so far always contested him. But it's only a momentary peace, and we hear no more of the scribe who was not far from the reign of God. One hopes that he made it all the way. Finally, we hear that no one had the courage to ask him any more questions. And this statement we find also in Matthew, at the end of the discussion which follows, and which Mark also recounts. Jesus asks the Pharisees whose son they think the Christ is, and they answer, David's. How is it then, says Jesus, that David calls him Lord? And he quotes the psalm.
The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand, and I will put your enemies under your feet.
And a scholar explains.
Everyone knew that the Messiah had to be a son of David. But Jesus, with an argument typical of the rabbis, invites them to take notice that the Messiah is greater than his ancestor David. In fact, David, saying that the Lord invites the Messiah to sit at his own right hand, calls the latter my Lord. Therefore, Jesus argues, the Messiah is superior even to David.
And so, writes Matthew, no one was able to answer him a word, nor from that day did anyone dare to ask him any more questions.
You have just heard Jill Bevilacqua and Sean Patrick Lovett. Now Joan Lewis and I take a look at the events of the Vatican's week. Joan, welcome back for another week.
Well, here we are, and it's been a busy week for the Holy Father and his usual Wednesday audience, which is covered quite amply, and we usually don't talk about that on this show, but we've had a couple of interesting ad limines in the past week. One is, of course, the bishops of Ireland have come in different groups for their ad limina visit, and then we had the Greek Episcopal Conference, and the content of the Holy Father's talks to them based on the particular situations in their country is very interesting. And with the Irish bishops, it was the Holy Father dedicated a good part of his talk to them to what he called the heart-rending cases of sexual abuse of minors. And he said these are, of course, all the more tragic when the abuser is a cleric. And the cases, apparently, they've just kind of come to the surface in the last couple years, maybe 2 or 3 years, but apparently have taken place, these cases of abuse, over a 40-year period. And the Holy Father was really, really devastated by this, as some of the bishops and their aides were saying afterwards to in media accounts, how personally devastated he was by these reports. And that's easy to understand. And so, of course, the Holy Father said at this point, what you have to do, we have wounds, where the deep wounds caused by such acts. And he said it's urgent to rebuild confidence and trust where both of these have been damaged. But he did make a very big point of saying that the fine work and selfless dedication of the great majority of priests and religious in Ireland should not be obscured by the transgressions of some of their brethren, and that is something too often forgotten by the media, who only highlight always the bad news, the case of abuse, and not the good work of 40 or 140 wonderful priests.
Yes, but I think it's also worth mentioning that a certain number of the allegations are completely false, and they are just made for the money.
Yes, they are, because people are kind of jumping on that bandwagon, and if they accuse somebody in the first place that they know is deceased, if it happened 30 or 40 years ago, they're now an adult, and they know that this person is deceased, that person can't defend themselves, but then there are others who are not deceased, and it's a question of
yes, but
proof.
Also, I was talking to somebody who was responsible for dealing with the allegations that are made against his own religious congregation. And he said the lawyers are saying that somebody should go for an allegation of sexual abuse because that carries the highest financial
rewards. Yeah.
And if that gets thrown out, well, they've got physical abuse, but it's still less money. And if that gets thrown out, they've still got verbal abuse and there's still the possibility of money. So some of the allegations are completely false and they are for money.
Well, you can understand why the Holy Father's heartbroken. I mean, I get heartbroken just hearing something like this myself. And that's the society we live in today, where the bottom line, I mean, is always money and how you get it. In this case, because of a lawsuit and perhaps not legitimate, it's very, very sad. So you have to pray for people who truly are victims and then people who, for whatever reason, are inventing this and perhaps harming, not perhaps, but certainly harming a wonderful priest in the meantime. But in any event, the another interesting factor that the Pope talked about to the Irish bishops was, he said, even if it's necessary to speak out loud against the evils that threaten us, we must correct the idea that Catholicism is a mere list of prohibitions. This is not the first time that Benedict has said something similar. You know, people just seem to think it's negatives and it's thou shalt nots and it's just the Ten Commandments. And he said, we really have to work hard, and he urged the priests to do this and the bishops. He said, we have to work hard to convince people of the joy that comes from religion, from knowing that Christ is at the center of your life, that he loves you, and living according to his commandments, some of which, of course, say, thou shalt not. However, that is what really does make you free in living those commandments. And then I thought it was, he said, if Christian commitment is considered unfashionable in some circles, he's indicated that there is a real spiritual hunger and generous desire to serve others among the young people of Ireland. Then we move ahead to this week, when the Holy Father, at the early part of the week, met the Greek Episcopal Conference. And it was very interesting. He was talking about the many problems that they face because of, among other things, the abundant influx, he called it, of Catholics from neighboring countries, which place great demands on the nation's clergy and religious, and for new requirements, if you will, of ministerial service that are not always easy to meet. And he kind of underlined the fact that Greece has a wide diversity of languages and rites. Now, he noted this, but said, respect for specific identities must always be borne in mind, but without sacrificing the life and plans, he said, of the churches that Christ entrusted to you. And then he highlighted two other specific aspects of the church in Greece, one of which, of course, is the fact that most Greeks belong to the Greek Orthodox Church, and the Pope urged the bishops and the faithful to increase their prayers so that one day the Greek Orthodox Church will be united with the Catholic Church. And then he just kind of segued into a problem that comes from the existence of those two churches, the fact that the Greek government only recognizes the Greek Orthodox Church. And this obviously creates tensions in communities and neighborhoods where both Greek Catholic and the Roman Catholic exist. And interestingly enough, the state of Greece regards Catholicism, the Catholic Church, as a private institution. So there's an awful lot of legal rights that they do not have that they are fighting for. And actually, I was studying up on this the other day. I didn't write this down in my notes, but I believe that even the Jews have a recognition by the state similar to or identical to the Greek Orthodox, but the Catholic Church does not have that. I know this was a very big issue when Pope John Paul made his visit to Greece. The subjects that Benedict brought up during this trip were very big issues with John Paul when he did make his trip to Greece. Now, another headliner news, of course, this week was the naming, the appointment in the Roman Curia of Brazilian Cardinal Claudio Umes as the prefect for the Congregation of the Clergy. This had been rumored in the press for about a week or maybe longer before his nomination. But it's a very interesting nomination. We actually have one Latin American, a Brazilian, South American, replacing another, because Cardinal Dario Castrion Hoyos, who's 77, are retiring for that reason, for reasons of age. He's from Colombia. So we do have a Latin American remaining in this position. And it's very interesting. I say Latin American. I know that in the United States, we are taught in school that there are 7 continents. I run this by people.
Really?
Oh, yes. Exactly. See, I run this by people all the time. And I'll ask an American, now, how many continents? Now, another headliner news, of course, this week was the naming, the appointment in the Roman Curia of Brazilian Cardinal Claudio Umes as the prefect for the Congregation of the Clergy. This had been rumored in the press for about a week or maybe longer before his nomination. But it's a very interesting nomination. We actually have one Latin American, a Brazilian, South American, replacing another, because Cardinal Dario Castrion Hoyos, who's 77, are retiring for that reason, for reasons of age. He's from Colombia. So we do have a Latin American remaining in this position. And it's very interesting. I say Latin American. I know that in the United States, we are taught in school that there are 7 continents. I run this by people.
Really?
Oh, yes. Exactly. See, I run this by people all the time. And I'll ask an American, now, how many continents did you learn there are in school? And the answer is always 7. And I'll tell you what they are. It's North America, South America, Europe, Asia, Africa, Oceania, and Antarctica is also a continent. So that's 7. And I know that there's been a concerted effort in the church, of course. John Paul, when he called the synod for, it was the Americas, or sometimes simply called America. And so you have North America, South America, and Latin America, all as geographical areas lumped together as one. And there are amazing differences, obviously, between a North America and a South America. So I mentioned this the other day on my website, and that for Europe, certainly for the Vatican, America refers to North and Central or South or Latin America.
Well, yes, because certainly in England, we learned there are 5 continents. We certainly didn't learn 7.
Yeah, well, that's it. All of Europe has always learned 5. When I came here one day and began working for the Vatican, and I was reading some document, and I said, oh, my goodness, they made a terrible mistake. They only mentioned 5 continents. And that's when I learned that's what they were taught.
An interesting cultural difference.
It is. It is, really. And so in any event, this cardinal, as I will say in a very American way, is from Latin America. And it's very interesting because Cardinal Umes, he's 72. He's a Franciscan. He was actually one of the cardinals mentioned in 2005, kind of as a front runner papabile, in the election, in the conclave that elected, of course, Pope Benedict. He's the oldest of 15 children, amazingly enough. Very, very large family. He was born of German immigrant family, so German actually is one of his languages, which can't harm his relations with the Holy Father, ties to the homeland of Germany, and then obviously speaking the language. And so I think he speaks four or five languages, obviously Portuguese, and then Spanish, and I think French and German, and I've forgotten what the fifth one would be.
Italian
is what I meant to say instead of French, of course. And I'm not sure if he does speak English or not. But what's interesting about looking at this appointment, if you look at the people that the Pope has named to high places, Cardinal Bertone, Secretary of State, so for Ivan Diaz even, very, very pastoral men. So that's a very...
Well, it's necessary because the Church might have a head, but it's also got a heart. The pastoral role is an essential manifestation of the Church's heart.
And then, interestingly enough, with Cardinal Ermes, he was the Bishop of Santo André for 21 years, and that's where we began to see his work with for social justice, and he defended workers, he supported unions, and actually he even participated in strikes as the bishop responsible for the pastoral ministry for workers in Brazil. He apparently had some role in inspiring, if you will, the movement towards democracy in Brazil in the 1980s. And, you know, he once said in an interview, in the last years of the military regime, when the first democratic movements began, the workers of Santo André had memorable strikes, and the Church declared her solidarity with the just demands of the workers and all those whose basic rights were being trampled on. In other words, how could you not do this? And at another time, kind of following really along the same thoughts, he had a meeting in the Vatican, I think it was in 2005, he told this gathering that solidarity with the poor is indispensable for world peace. And then he asked a question, which a lot of people have asked since then, does not terrorism today have as one of its ingredients a revolt against imposed poverty? That really gives you pause for thought. So it'd be very interesting to watch his work. And
right. Thank you, Joan.
Well, we will be back next week at this time.
And we finish with a prayer from a saint. Saint Therese of Lisieux. I have only today. My life is an instant, an hour which passes by. My life is a moment which I have no power to stay. You know, O my God, that to love you here on earth, I have only today. You have been listening to me, Sister Janet Ferns, and to Joan Lewis, Gilbert Villacqua, and Sean Patrick Lovett. You can hear us all again at the same time next week, or at your leisure, by going to the internet and clicking on English at vaticanradio.org. Until we meet again, may God bless you.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.